Today is a family day. Parents, relatives, and friends have gathered this morning to witness this milestone in the life of these young people. And so it's an important day for families to come together to witness this graduation. But it's not just a biological family day, it's also a university family day. In a real sense, all at this university have been working toward this day. And so we exist to transform lives in an academic community that integrates higher learning with biblical truth and service to God and humanity. But not only is it a biological family day and a university family day, but it's also a family day for the larger community, dignitaries and leaders from throughout the valley, partners with Ohio Valley University, have all gathered today to celebrate the advancement and the achievement of these young people. So today is a family day. Today's ceremony reminds me of a graduation that took place years ago. I was one of 13 graduating with a doctorate degree from Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And we were gathered together with 18,000 of our closest friends in the Bradley Center in downtown Milwaukee. There was no rehearsal. There was no printed order. We just received instructions that there would be a verbal prompt in the graduation ceremony to tell us what to do. Our only real instruction was that the 13 of us were to sit on the second row of the Bradley Center. And so we all filed in no particular order. I just happened to file in last and ended up on the side aisle. And in front of us was this large platform. It was head high, and it covered all of the territory where the goalpost of the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team normally stood. And so the ceremony began, and then at one point in the proceedings, someone at the podium said, "Will the candidates for the Doctor of Philosophy degree please stand?" And so 13 of us stood up. And then it became apparent to me, having been on the end of the row, that I was going to be the first one to graduate. There was no one to follow, no footsteps in front of me, but I was going to be the first one. And I've never been first with a name like Shank that starts with S. I'm usually near the end of the line. But I approached these long stairs leading up to this high platform, handed my 3x5 card to the announcer. She read my name and my degree. I mounted the stairs, walked past several dignitaries who shook my hand, received my diploma, and then came face to face with the last person in the line, the president of the university. He congratulated me, shook my hand. And then I was filled with confusion because I wasn't quite sure how I was to exit. There had been no instructions. And so I looked at the president, whom I'd never met before, never spoken to before, and I said, "Do you know what I'm supposed to do now?" And he replied, "I have no idea." And then suddenly the double meaning of that question and answer hit the both of us, and we started to laugh, and there were 18,000 people wondering what this president and graduate student were laughing about. And then suddenly there was a voice from the other end of the stage and a loud whisper that said, "Exit here." And I went over to find a hidden set of stairs, went down and took my seat. Do you know what I'm supposed to do now? All graduates face that question. But not only do those getting degrees face that question, but all of us ask that inquiry with regularity. What should I do with my life? Should I take that promotion? Should I sign that agreement? Where do I get a job? Where should I live? What is life about? What do I hope to accomplish? Most of us answer those questions by following somebody else. We decide to do what our father did. Or we follow our mother. or we do what our peer group is doing, or we have networked with some people and we decide to follow them, but we end up following somebody else to some place for some reason. Jean-Henri Fabre was the famous French naturalist, lived about a century ago, died just at the beginning of World War I. He was out in the French forest one day observing nature when he came across a long line of processional caterpillars making their way through the forest floor. Processional caterpillars have a leader, and then they line up behind that leader, tail to head, tail to head, tail to head, in a long line, and they march front to back through the forest. And as Fabre was observing this long line of insects, it occurred to him to try an experiment. And so he gathered a sampling of the insects, took them back to his laboratory, where he had a large earthen flower pot with a huge rim on it. And he put the processional caterpillars on the rim of that flower pot, head to tail, head to tail, head to tail, until he had a complete unbroken circle. And he started them moving around the rim of the flower pot. And they began their journey, their circular journey to nowhere, one following the other. And even though he had food and some places to rest, the processional caterpillars continued on their merry journey to nowhere. He watched them hour after hour, all morning, all afternoon, all evening, went to bed, got up the next morning. The processional caterpillars were still making their circular journey until one by one they collapsed from exhaustion. Jack Higgins is the British novelist, wrote 60 books. The Legal Has Landed was his most famous, sold 50 million copies, story of World War II. It came out at the high point of his career, and he said that there was one thing that he wished that he had known when he was a young boy, and that is, when you get to the top of the mountain of life, there's nothing there. Lee Iacocca was born up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, made a career at Ford and then at Chrysler in Detroit. In his book, Straight Talk, he said, "Here I am in the twilight years of my life, still wondering what life is all about. I've gained fame and fortune, but I can tell you this, fame and fortune are for the birds. Do you know what I'm supposed to do now? Do we simply follow the human caterpillar in front of us on our merry journey to nowhere? Do we arrive at the top and find it empty? Do we reach retirement filled with regrets and cynicism? We are going to follow somebody. I have a very simple suggestion. Follow Jesus." For the last 20 centuries, there have been millions of believers and non-believers who have widely thought that Jesus was the most remarkable person who ever lived. The things he said, the actions he took, the moves he made, continue to strike people as absolutely astonishing. He started a movement of people that have existed throughout the centuries that have generally followed a higher standard. There are three word pictures that describe what I'm trying to say, and behind each picture is a biblical passage. The first picture is mirror, mirror. In Acts chapter 11, verse 26, it says the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. The word Christian is a Greek word that means to look like Jesus. The image is we look in the mirror, and in the mirror we see Jesus, and we try to make our lives a reflection of His. The second image is the body. In the book of Ephesians, in the first chapter near the end, it says that Jesus is the head and we are the body. We know how the body works. The head says to my hand, shake, and so my hand shakes. My head says to my feet, make the body go up and down, and the body goes up and down. Jesus speaks. The body listens. Mirror, body. The third image is a footprint. 1 Peter 2, chapter 2, verse 21, says that we are to follow in the footsteps of Jesus. The images of Jesus walking across the beaches of life, and he leaves his footprints in the sand. We come along and put our feet where he's walked. Mirror, body, footprint. Well, we don't have to be a Jack Higgins and write 60 novels, or a Lee Iacocca and turn a car manufacturer around to follow Jesus. James Davidson Hunter last year wrote the book To Change the World. Hunter is religious sociologist at the University of Virginia, one that coined the phrase culture wars back in the 1990s. He tells about a woman that he knew who was a Christian. She spent her life in a grocery store, ringing up and bagging groceries. Her sphere of influence was 6 square feet. And yet she decided that she was going to greet every customer with enthusiasm and joy. She learned their names, knew most of the names of their families, and she would always send them off with their receipt and their bananas and milk with the line, tonight I'll pray for your family. Well, eventually it caused problems for the store because all the customers wanted to be in her line. There'd be a long queue waiting to check out with her, and the other cash registers would be nearly empty. She finally retired. Sometime after that, she passed away. Hunter says that the church was packed to standing room only for her funeral. It went on for hours as people who had gone through her line went to the front to praise her influence on their lives. What was she doing? She was following Jesus. Or I think of Robert Solomon, an attorney, for many years the Associate Dean of Admissions at The Ohio State University. Robert and his wife have become known in Central Ohio for their marriage and family seminars that they conduct. He's the Associate Minister with the Genesee Avenue Church of Christ. Robert's a 1984 graduate of Northeastern Christian Junior College and alumnus of the year 2006 at Ohio Valley University. Why does Robert do what he does? He's following Jesus. Or I think of Judy Tenney, grew up in Pennsboro, West Virginia, now coaches and teaches at Greater Atlanta Christian School. Her teams have won 4 state championships. Judy graduated from Ohio Valley University in 1975, received the OVU Medal of Merit for Education at last year's homecoming. Why does Judy do what she does? She's following Jesus. I think of Earl Lavender. My wife Sally considers him one of her favorite authors. His last book, Living God's Love, An Invitation to Christian Spirituality, came out in 2009. He's professor of Bible at Lipscomb, has been doing that for decades, graduated from Ohio Valley University in 1975. Why does Earl do what he does? Is following Jesus. Years ago, there was another sort of school. Some of the faculty gathered together to talk about some unanswered questions that they had. And as they were doing so, a young boy wandered into their classroom. He started asking them questions. One thing led to another, and pretty soon, the professors were getting their questions answered by this 12-year-old boy. Then his parents barged into the room. We've been searching all over town for you for 3 days. Jesus, what are you doing here? His mother, Mary, asked. Jesus said, don't you know that I must be about my Father's business? Well, it's an old story, but it tells us 2 things. One, Jesus had a purpose. He knew where he was going. He said, I must be about my Father's business. Read through the Gospel of Luke, and we find that Jesus says that line over and over again. I must do this. I must say that. I must speak here. I must talk to these people. He had purpose in his life. And secondly, Jesus knew his purpose was tied up with God. I must be about my Father's business, my Father's house. He knew that hope was tied up with God. He knew that God was the creator, that God was the sustainer. He believed that the world only made sense when viewed through a worldview that was God-informed. Jesus knew his purpose was tied up with God. People are not the only ones who follow Jesus. Ohio Valley University seeks to follow Jesus. We believe, and we will continue to believe, that God is the hope for the world, that God is the creator. We believe that God is the sustainer of all that is. We believe that the world only makes sense when viewed from a Christian worldview. Alexander Solzhenitsyn tells of being as a young man in a Soviet labor camp. One day he was out working in the fields with the other prisoners. The rations were meager. The sleeping and living quarters were very stark. The slow process of back-breaking labor and slow starvation had taken its toll on Solzhenitsyn. And so one day, he just gave up. There was no reason to go on. There was nothing to hope for. And he sat down on a log and decided he wasn't going to do it anymore. He knew the guard would be along shortly. The guard would tell him to get back to work. He was going to refuse. He knew the guard would beat him. He was going to continue to refuse. And he knew the guard would beat him to death. This was the day he would die. As he sat on the log, he noticed that there was an older man sitting next to him. The old man had a stick in his hand, and he reached over, and on the ground between Solzhenitsyn's feet, he took the stick and he drew an outline of a cross. Solzhenitsyn saw the image in the sand, and suddenly his entire perspective shifted. He picked up his shovel. He went back to work. He survived the camp. He had a reason for going on. It's easy to dismiss all this. Some of you are having stomach pains, telling you that lunchtime is getting close, and you're wondering how long this guy is going to go. And you know that you need to gas up before you make the trip home. There are bills to pay, urgent things demanding our attention. It reminds me of a story told by Robert Fulghum in his book, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. He was attending a conference where peace advocate Alexander Papaderos was speaking. Near the end, he was doing some questions and answers. And he finally asked if there were any more questions. And Fulghum raised his hand and he said, "What is the meaning of life?" People laughed, got up, started to leave as if the thought of anybody answering that question was beyond reason. But Papaderos took the question seriously and he said, no, I'll answer the question. And the crowd became silent and went back to their seats. Papaderos took out his wallet, started fishing around, and drew out a small mirror. It was oddly shaped. He said that I was a child growing up in Eastern Europe during World War II. A German soldier came through on his motorcycle. He upset, and the rearview mirror was broken. And the pieces were scattered over the road, and he left them there. And I came out as a small child and found those pieces and tried to put them back together, but I couldn't. So I saved the largest piece, this one. And I took a stone, and I ground off the rough edges, and it became my plaything. And I found that I could take this mirror and find a light source, and I could shine light into crevices, into corners, into closets. It became a game with me. But when I became a man, I realized it wasn't a game. It was a metaphor of life. I realized I'm not the light. I'm not the source. But I'm a mirror that reflects the light. into the dark places of the world. It's a daily choice that we face. Do we follow the human caterpillar in front of us until we fall in exhaustion? Do we climb to the top of the mountain, get to retirement, find out it's not what we thought it was? Do we eat lunch, get gas for the car, and never think about what we're doing in life? Or do we become a mirror and reflect the light of Jesus? I hope you will choose the latter.